I call the joint meeting of the Senate Resources and Finance Committee to meetings to order. Today is Friday, January 19th, 2018. Got to get the right date on there. Let the record reflect that it is 9 a.m. We're here in Juneau in the Senate Finance Committee room. I am Kathy Giesel, the chair of the Senate Resources Committee, and I will welcome my Resource Committee members, Senator Bishop, Senator Meyer, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Coghill, who is the vice chair of this committee. Excused today is Senator Stedman. Senator McKinnon, would you introduce the Senate Finance Committee members?
Thank you, Chair Giesel. I'm Senator Anna McKinnon, co-chair of Finance. With me this morning from Finance, there will be a repeat of a few names. Co-chairman Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Stevens, Senator Bishop, and excused today is Senator Machicki.
Great. Thank you very much. I also want to welcome in the audience Representatives Dave Tallarico and Andy Josephson. These two representatives serve with me on the HB 111 Working Group, and so welcome to those two House members. Supporting us today, we have Recording Secretary Laura, and helping out on audio is Leah. So why are we meeting today? The legislature passes laws. We passed a law recently, just a few months ago, called House Bill 111, which affected tax credits. Those laws then are passed on to departments where bureaucrats write additional laws. Those laws are called rules. They may simply be called rules, but they have the force of law. And they're written by bureaucrats, the word meaning ruling from the desk. We want to make sure that the rules that are written by those bureaucrats match with the laws that are passed and intended by the legislature. We spend a lot of time deliberating. We hear facts from experts. We debate issues and wrestle those facts to the ground and write laws. We want to make sure that those rules that are then written to enforce those laws are accurate. We have House Bill 111 rules before us. We're going to examine one package that is almost complete. There is a second package, which you have a copy of, that is out for public comment right now. And my understanding is that there'll be a third package of rules that will be coming out later. So we will be examining these, the first package today. So I want to welcome the chief maker of rules, ruling from his desk, tax director, Mr. Ken Alper, to the table. And with him is the audit master of the tax division, Mr. John Larson, who also helped write these rules. So, gentlemen, if you would come to the table, we welcome you. The tax division has provided us with a PowerPoint today that I expect they'll be going through. And gentlemen, as you're presenting, of course you know we're recording this and it's also being broadcast, and so folks listening may not identify your voices. If you would identify yourself as you speak each time. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Tax Division Director with the Department of Revenue. Before we get started, I just want to clarify one thing, and that is there are actually two packages of regulations related to this bill, House Bill 111. One of them is complete. It has been signed. It is now, it has the force of law, so such as it is. The second is in its process right now, and I'll get to how deep into that process. We could speak generally about it, but can't talk about certain details because of the process. I want to take a moment to introduce the gentleman sitting next to me. He might be new to many members of the committee, but he's not new to the state. John Larson is an audit master. Those are the subject matter experts, the production tax specialist positions that were created when Alaska switched to the net profits-based tax to provide certain expert assistance in administering this tax. John has been with us for 10 years and has had the primary role of really leading the regulations drafting process for the last several of the oil and gas tax bills that have passed the legislature. And as we've discussed, we get a lot of these. They're big, they're complicated pieces of legislation. They require a lot of interpretation and implementation, and John has done a tremendous job for 10 years of translating the legislature's will into the nitty-gritty detailed paragraphs that enable us to implement these rules going forward. It's people like that often don't get enough credit in the complex bureaucracy that we try to run. So I just wanted to give that to John. And before we get into the meat of it, I wanted to, per request of the Department of Law, read a brief disclaimer about the process we have before us today. We have been asked to present on recent regulations from a process standpoint. Importantly, the Department of Regulations has one set of regulations that are currently noticed or for public comment. This legislative hearing is not part of the public comment process for the adoption of regulations. The committee members, as well as any member of the public who are listening and wish to comment on the regulations, should comment as provided in the public notice. The notice, as well as the full text of the proposed regulations, are available on the department's website, and I noticed, Madam Chair, that your aide also put copies on the desk, which means I'm assuming they're on basis with the committee record. The public comment period closes next Friday, January 26th. For the pending regulations, we cannot discuss how they would be applied. Testimony today should not be construed as any predetermination of any final regulations. Our presentation today is focused on factual information about the Department of Revenue's recent and ongoing regulations process. And I thank you for your latitude to simply read that into the record. John, do you want to put your name on the record as well?
Sure. My name is John Larson. I'm audit master with the Alaska Department of Revenue, and thank you for having me here today.
Welcome.
So, Madam Chair, in the last two legislative sessions, there have been two major bills passed that both fit into this realm of what we're calling tax credit reform, or sort of a ramping back from the more generous historic program of providing direct support to exploration and development. So I wanted to just recap the content of these bills before we get into what's pending. House Bill 247, most of you recall, passed in the 2016 legislative session. And just one slide on what it did. We phased out the Cook Inlet tax credits and reduced the Middle Earth tax credits similarly. So we still are offering credits in what we call Middle Earth. That's the interior parts of the state, not Cook Inlet and not North Slope. Meanwhile, and this was discussed at the working group meeting last night, the Cook Inlet gas tax cap was extended. It was scheduled to sunset in 2022, and a new tax of $1 per barrel cap was added to Cook Inlet oil. We added sunset provisions, which some referred to as graduation provisions, to the North Slope gross value reduction. That's the new oil reduced tax treatment that originally was passed to be indefinite and is now somewhere between 3 and 7 years, depending on the price of oil. That treatment will go away, and the oil will graduate and begin to be taxed as legacy oil after that point. We put a cap in on the amount of cash through the credit system that a company could receive per company per year. We created a resident higher priority when there is limited cash as to how we allocate it, who gets first access to it, or those companies with higher Alaska resident hire for themselves and their primary contractors. We added a little bit of transparency where there's now an annual report where we announce to the public how much cash was received by each company in aggregate over the course of that calendar year. The first of those reports came out in April of last year based on 2016 information. There will be another report coming out in April of this year with the 2017 information. There was an interest rate change that applied just to the production tax. It increased the rate for 3 years and then reduced the rate to zero. There was some technical cleanup of provisions that were remnants from old laws or things that weren't working properly that were also passed with 247. And finally, after that happened, there was a regulations package that was proposed. It was adopted. It went through the same process that I'm about to describe today for House Bill 111, and those regulations were effective in January of 2017. So that was 2016. 2017's bill, House Bill 111, was in many ways even more aggressive because it eliminated the regime of the state buying cash tax credits. That was a big shift. Most credits were no longer eligible for state repurchase after July 1st of 2017. The bill was actually slightly retroactive in that way. With the exception of the refinery credits and the LNG storage credits, these are credits that have their own built-in sunsets in the next couple of years, so they will also be going away soon. The net operating loss credit, which is by far the largest component of the cash credit program, was outright repealed effective January 1st of this year. There is no more net operating loss credit or carried forward annual loss credit, as it was formerly known. Instead, this was replaced with a new structure of what we call carried forward lease expenditures or carried forward losses. And a large portion of the bill was detailing the treatment of how those carried forward losses were to be calculated and eventually how they were to be recaptured when a company brought their field into production. One key provision was known as the ring fence, the idea that these carried forwards losses can't be used until the underlying leases come into production. There was flexibility given where the taxpayer could choose how much they did or didn't want to use in a given year to maximize their flexibility to use any other tax credits or reductions they might have available to them. There was limitations there specifically that you can't use your carried forwards below to reduce taxes below the minimum tax. There was a form of indirect floor hardening that the legislature undertook last year in ensuring that carried forwards wouldn't be used to reduce taxes to zero. And then a new provision was added to say that if they are not used for 10 years, they begin to, on a graduated scale, start to lose value, a provision that some referred to as a downlift. Continuing on, the other things in that bill, there was another interest rate change. The Department of Revenue had expressed some concerns with the prior change and the carving out of production tax versus other taxes. Now all of the taxes administered by the Department of Revenue have the same interest treatment, and there is no sunsetting of the interest. The interest continues for as long as a delinquency remains or an appeal. Sometimes these can go on for 10 years. A new provision, which was a major focus of our regulations, the idea that a credit can now be used backwards in time, that a credit, whether by the originator of the credit or by the purchaser of the credit, you could take a tax credit and use it to offset a tax liability for a year earlier than the year in which the credit was earned. And that could also be used to offset penalties and interest that might be associated with those past year liabilities. The key limitation, of course, is the Alaska Constitution. There's the Constitutional Budget Reserve says that tax liabilities related from an administrative proceeding or a settlement of certain lawsuits must go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We can't supersede that by law. So any past year liabilities that fit the CBRF definition cannot be offset with tax credits. And we got some legal guidance and put some brackets around what does and doesn't fit inside this new ability that was added in last year's legislation. Another thing that was added was the idea that exploration tax credits, which often take a long time to review for a variety of reasons, and that was once time became a factor and money became an issue, they were falling behind in the queue and the ability to get in line to receive cash payments. So we are now giving them conditional tax credit certificates so that they can reserve their place in line in advance of getting the final review and awarding of those tax credits for exploration. The seismic credit on the North Slope and Cook Inlet had previously sunset before last year, but it remains in Middle Earth. The Middle Earth seismic credit was repealed as of January 1st, 2018. Another addition to these Middle Earth exploration credits is they now can be used to offset the company's corporate income tax. To put some perspective on that, there is no production of oil and gas from Middle Earth yet. We are hoping that someone finds some and develops it. The companies that are doing that work tend to be the regional native corporations. We heard from Mr. Mahoney from Otna yesterday. His company has been involved in this exploration for oil and gas, and they're part of the state. Should they discover some or their exploration tax credits that they are earning on that work can be used to offset those companies' corporate income tax liability. That is a new freedom that they have. We also, because the tax credit fund is no longer going to be needed after the last credit is paid, which could be any time between next year and roughly 2026, There's a delayed repealer built in, that the fund itself and its underlying language and rules goes away after the last credit is paid. And finally, we established the legislative working group, and Madam Chair, you were chairing that working group's meeting yesterday afternoon in this very room. So that was the law. And then we say, now what do? The governor signed that law on July 28th, and we looked at it and realized this was too big to do in one set of regulations, in part because certain things needed to be done relatively fast. We really needed the rules in place by January 1st for a variety of reasons related to the interest or this idea of carry back. But the carried forward lease expenditures were very complicated, very sensitive. They needed more time, and they frankly didn't need to be entirely pinned down by January 1st because no one was going to try to use them or claim them until the end of 2018. They're starting to be earned in the beginning of 2018. So we split the package in half. The first package was the carryback, the interest rates, and most of the smaller provisions of the bill. And then the second package was related to the carry forward, how they're earned, how they're calculated, how they're allocated, and most importantly, how they're used once the field comes into production. So before either package was written, we had a workshop, a scoping workshop. This was designed to get input from affected parties, primarily industry, as to what they expected to see in the regulations, what they hoped to see, what their understanding of the law as it passed was, what the hot button issues might be that we wanted to give a little bit of extra attention to. There were 22 attendees at that meeting from industry, plus those that were on the phone and folks from the Department of Revenue. We received comments. We actually extended the comment period because of factors beyond our control. Many of the AOGA members have offices in Houston that were impacted by Hurricane Harvey last summer. It took a while for Houston to get back on its feet, and we gave some extra time to make sure people could get their comments in. We received comments from 8 different parties. Now, AOGA generally comments on these things, and they're speaking on behalf of multiple parties. So it's really more than 8 interested parties. Senator Giesel, you yourself commented, as well as Representative Seaton added comment to the public comment process on the pre-scoping workshop. I'm going to pause here before I get to the regulations themselves to see if there's any questions from your committee.
Well, first of all, I'll interject, Director Alper, that I appreciate that you did that pre-regulation scoping meeting. I don't know that you commonly do that or that departments commonly do that, but I appreciate that you did that. It is a complex subject you were dealing with.
And thank you, Madam Chair. It's helpful. It's not required. We like to do it when we can. Sometimes you've got a ticking clock that makes it harder. In this particular case, and I have a bullet to this effect a little bit later on, the bill passed with what they called retroactive regulatory authority. In other words, we can't go backwards to 2010 or something, but should the regulations take effect because of all the process after the effective date of the bill, January 1st, 2018, the regs could be taken back to the effective date of the bill. That's an important authority that gives us the leeway to maybe spend an extra few weeks in process, especially, frankly, bills don't usually pass in July. Big bills usually pass in April or May, and that couple of months makes a big difference when we had the extended sessions like last year.
Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing none.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the scoping work picked out some of the major issues, highlighting some of the issues that we had to address with the regulation. There was language that got added late to the bill about exploration expenditures in the context of the ring fence. When it's expenditures developing a field and they're ring fenced, you know what that means. When the field, those expenses are tied to that field. But what if you're exploring? What if you're drilling multiple exploration wells and only one of them finds something? Is there a mechanism for the company to be able to regain value from the failed exploration wells? And the language provided to us was reasonably related. So we had to hang some flesh on the term reasonably related. That was one of the tasks that we had. Another issue was the idea of the termination of the ring fence. The triggering provision for the use of carried forwards was when a field came into, quote, regular production. Regular production is an AOGCC, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, definition. It's not from the tax statutes, and we needed to align the idea that HB 111 talked about regular production from a lease or a property, whereas AOGCC generally refers to that from an individual well. So we needed to make a little bit of a judgment call as to how to make that determination. Finally, the allocation issue was essential. If you have multiple fields happening at the same time, multiple development projects, or if you have a company easily imaginable that has production and revenue on the one hand, but a large development project on the other hand, that might put them negative, put them into a loss situation for the overall year, making sure that only the amount of the loss was tied up in the ring fence and not the entirety of the expenditure on the new development. So to give as much benefit as possible to the companies doing more than one thing at a time. And there was another interesting concern with gas used in state. You'll hear us use the term segment. A segment is a taxable area. North Slope Oil and Gas is a segment. Cook-Inlet Oil, Cook-Inlet Gas, Middle Earth. In other words, the taxes are calculated differently for each segment, and lease expenditures get allocated for each segment. Gas used in state is a separate segment, and it pays tax at the Cook-Inlet Gas tax cap rate of 17 cents. But because of that, the lease expenditures have to get allocated to that gas used in state, and that became a little bit of a complexity and something that we had some public comment about from industry about how we did that. And finally, the retroactive regulation question that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and again, thank you for giving us that authority. It made it a better regulations process that we did not have to rush, because here we sit in mid-January, and we're still not, quote-unquote, done, presuming we get to the public comment deadline and we redraft the regulations and the Department of Law does their review and then it goes to the Lieutenant Governor and then finally they get filed and made official 30 days after the Lieutenant Governor signs them. We'll be somewhere in March before we're done, but these regulations will have the effect of law on January 1st because of that retroactive authority we were given in the bill. So thank you. So the regulations process, there's a lot of statute and a little bit of custom. There was an administrative order from a few years ago that recommended these workshops but did not mandate them, as well as a discussion draft, pre-official drafts. They are helpful, and we use that administrative order to say let's have a workshop. The second step would be publication of draft language. That's the step we're on right now with what we're calling Packet 2. There is a very tightly prescribed series of steps for the draft language published in a newspaper of general circulation on the state's online public notice system, furnished to to our interested parties list, to the Department of Law. All legislators get it. I'm sure you all get these emails from various regulations throughout the state. Also, the chairs of the impacted committees, the Administrative Regulations Review Committee gets a copy, Legislative Council. So there's a lot of dissemination at the front end of any draft regulation. We have 140 people on the interested parties list for these oil and gas regulations. So there's a lot of names and a lot of folks that might get themselves involved in the process. Step three is the Administrative Procedures Act, which is statute, requires public notice period, at least 30 days. We try to give a little bit longer than that when we're laying out the calendar. And typically, although not mandatorily, there's a public hearing. We'll notice a public hearing. We will get a room with a recorder, and we'll have an on-the-record conversation where people can give public testimony. Ideally, you do that somewhere in the middle of the public comment period, because others could listen in to another company or another interested party's comments and use that to inform their own comments. Oftentimes you'll get both spoken comment and then written comment slightly modified from the same interested parties. And at the deadline, all of the public comments are public record. We publish them on the department's website. They are distributed to each other. We let everyone know what everyone said formally and on the record. And that's, again, why I said this hearing is not considered part of that public record. No one at the Department of Revenue is transcribing this and making your questions part of the public comment period on House Bill 111. So prior to drafting the final regulations, the
Director Alper, could you pause for a moment? Senator Hoffman had a question.
For the listening audience, the public record once published, does that include who made those comments?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, it does. In fact, if there's a letter on letterhead with names and phone numbers, all of that becomes part of the public record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But we take the comments and the draft regulations, make what edits we might need to put together a final regulation. So ultimately, that's the process. What the Administrative Procedures Act requires is that we must consider, now that's a broad word, all of the public comments, keep a record or use of how we considered them, how we rejected them. The document we submit is called an Affidavit of Agency Record of Public Comment that comes along with the final adopted regulations. So there's this legal document that says these are the comments received and this is how we reacted to them in transitioning from the draft to the final regulations package. And if I said any of that wrong, John will probably step in and correct me because he's a lot tighter on the details than I am. So finally, we get the final regulations. We create a final regulations packet. This is now, for our intents and purposes, done. It is adopted. It is signed by the Commissioner of Revenue, the Commissioner of the impacted department, and then it goes to the Department of Law. The Department of Law, at that point, is ensuring that what we are proposing is within the authority conferred by the department, by the law itself that passed. It's not conflicting with other statutes. It's not repeating statutes. They're making sure that we are not overreaching with these regulations. So that's an important filter before they become official. That usually takes a couple of weeks. There are some very meticulous text editors. That's where any stray commas get pulled out as well, or ands and ors, and those kind of grammatical errors will get found by the Department of Law in that final legal review as well. The legislature is informed that there's a pending regulation. There is an option to review. This is the point at which, at times, the Administrative Regulations Review Committee might get involved. That doesn't happen all the time, but it's within the legislature's authority. And again, typically, there's technical revisions at that point. The final version after the Department of Law goes to the Lieutenant Governor. He signs them, and then they are officially law 30 days after that filing or signing by the Lieutenant Governor. If the regulations for some reason specify some other date, a future date, then obviously they become effective on that date instead of 30 days afterwards. So, on to the actual regulations, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair. So regulations package one, to refresh what I said a little while ago, is everything except carried forwards, with the carried back provisions being the most complex or controversial. The timeline there was on September 27th, we published the draft and put out the public notice. Again, it was August 22nd, so about 5 weeks earlier, where we had put out the discussion draft. There was not that much that changed as far as the language between the discussion draft and the official draft, but there were a few changes made. We had a public hearing. We had a public comment period. You could see by the calendar, about 5 weeks, more than 30 days. These were signed by the Lieutenant Governor and made and published, and by January 1st, they were the law of the land. Now, the clear intent here from this body was to strengthen the secondary market. And this is a term that everyone might not be familiar with. What we're talking about is the ability of companies that are holding cashable tax credits where the state might not have cash available to be able to sell these credits to another company who could then use them to offset their taxes, the secondary market for tax credits. There are a variety of reasons why that market had not been used, primarily because the state was buying all of the credits for about 8 years that were presented. There was no need for it. Once the demand was there, there wasn't very much market, primarily because of low oil prices and the potential buyers of those credits. Alaska's major oil and gas producers didn't have enough tax liability to be able to buy credits to further reduce them. They were limited in their ability to reduce their taxes. But the intent of the legislature was to strengthen that secondary market. And here's an important thing that happened, because I mentioned earlier that the typical past year tax liability is an audit. We audit someone's 2012 taxes and say, I'm sorry, company, you underpaid for a variety of reasons. You owe us $30 million plus interest. Well, an audit is very clearly an administrative proceeding. The Supreme Court has said this, and that money goes to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. All the money that comes to the state as a result of tax audits on oil and gas goes to the Constitutional Budget Reserve, full stop. However, there was a major settlement that's still being finalized, but it's been agreed to on TAPS tariffs, on the pipeline tariffs going back to about 2010-11. And what the Attorney General advised us was that that is not litigation related to tax. It's litigation related to tariffs. And that the fact that there's more taxes, that's a secondary impact of it. Because if you can imagine, we're reducing the allowable tariffs. We're reducing the transportation charges for oil through the pipeline. What that means is the value of the oil up at the wellhead is a little bit higher. That higher value translates through as a larger royalty liability and a larger tax liability. That tax liability did not have to go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve, therefore creating a little bit of a window where there's a secondary market where companies who might owe that tax could purchase tax credits to offset that liability. And we're talking about $165 million of estimated past year tax liability for 2011, 12, and 13 that we are hoping will be used to absorb some of the hanging tax credit balances that are out there. Now, so there's that. There are some changes that we were able to make prior to the regulations being final. The idea of conditional exploration certificates, we were able to do that right away. We had I'm close to $100 million worth of exploration applications sitting in our work pool, and we were able to give them conditional certificates so that all of those were able to be 2017 tax credit certificates. As we rank order these for cash, the process is first we have to pay off all of the 2016 originating certificates, then we have to pay off all the 2017s, and then all of the 2018s. Within, say, the 2017s, that's where this local higher rank order will come in. But the first and most important rank order is by year of origin. So we got all of the explorers into the 2017 pool through your change to conditional certificates. So these were the things, and this was some of, again, the guidance that we were given by the legislature that we were trying to implement. And I'm going to take a breath this moment to see if we have any questions.
Well, actually, I do have a question here, and I was going to wait till we actually got to the regulations, but since you just explained the conditional credits, it might be good to ask the question here while everybody's mind is sort of on it. So there is the opportunity for the division to deny a conditional credit. Is that true? Or to deny a credit?
Madam Chair, the guidance per House Bill 111 is that the conditional credit is given when it's requested. So there's no review initially. But the conditional credit cannot be sold or cashed. It's simply a placeholder. They can't actually get any money until we've issued it, but what they're reserving is their place in line. Between the issuing of the credit and the finalizing of it, that's where our audit process, our review process will kick in, and generally there's some adjustment. Rarely are they go out 100% of the way they come in, and that's when we'll be making those, or perhaps denying them outright if there's some reason it's not an eligible applicant. But up until that point, that conditional certificate is for 100% of the amount requested.
So how often, well, since it's rather new, you may not know, but what's the likelihood of a conditional application being denied?
Madam Chair, it's very rare. There's always some adjustment, and sometimes that's to qualify for the exploration credit, they have to be expenditures outside of a unit boundary, and sometimes you'll get a hybrid application for, say, a seismic shoot where some of it's inside a unit and some of it's outside, and the acreage inside the unit has to instead qualify for the for the operating loss credit or something similar like that. So we've got to reallocate some or expenditures for something that's not in use, a reserve fee for a rig that never actually got used during the year can't be credited in that year, but if they do use the rig in a subsequent year, they can sort of bring forward those costs and claim them in the next year. There's always adjustments, and the auditors are much deeper into the details of that, but it would be very unusual to full on say, no, we're going to reject this credit outright. It's more likely they'll adjust it by a few percentage points for some reason.
So it's adjusted, but it's still with the adjustments, then it's an accepted conditional credit. Is that an accurate statement?
Madam Chair, once the adjustments are made, it's no longer a conditional credit. So they'll apply for, let's say, a $10 million credit. We'll give them a $10 million conditional credit to reserve their place in the line. We'll review it and say, I'm sorry, company, it's only a $9.5 million credit, but now it's a real credit and it's eligible for cash.
And so I'm just going through the logistics now. So now that real credit that's been reviewed, that was applied for as a conditional, goes into the queue, the lineup and priority. They haven't really lost any place in line as a result, or has there been a delay that might move them from, say, slot number 4 in that priority list to maybe slot number 10?
There is not, Madam Chair. Okay. And realistically, I believe there were 12 of these conditional credit certificates that we gave out in August. Of those 12, something like 7 of them were finalized before December 31st anyway, so it wouldn't have mattered, honestly, because they fell into the 2017 pool. But for the other 5, who won't be getting their final certificate until sometime in 2018, they are reserving their identical spot in the 2017 pool. Now, no 2017 certificates have been purchased yet. We still have about $400 million worth of 2016 certificates on the books. The next $400 million appropriated by the legislature will pay off those 2016 certificates before we get to any of the 2017 certificates. Caveat, the administration will be introducing legislation to possibly bond for this and pay them off in a different manner. But setting that aside, under current law, that's the law. So let's presume for a moment that the legislature appropriates $500 million in the coming budget cycle towards tax credits. That would entirely pay off the 2016 pool, and then the first $100 million of the 2017 pool, and then we would get to the rank order question. Under the current rules, the priority among the 2017 pool would go to those with the highest Alaska resident hire. And as long as you're in the 2017 pool, whether you came in as a conditional certificate in August or as a operating loss certificate in July or a certificate issued on December 31st, that doesn't matter. You will get your priority based on the resident hire percentage.
Thank you. I appreciate the clear explanation then of how those will work. That's great. Thank you. Senator Bishop had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, Director, you talked about the negative adjustment on a conditional. Have you ever seen a positive adjustment on a conditional?
Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, yes, it's less common, and not just for exploration credits. All credit applications are reviewed, capital expenditure credits, operating loss credits, and there have been occasions where a company has made an error in the state's favor, and we'll catch it and we'll increase the number.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Alpert, are you at liberty to share the legal opinion from the Attorney General on your ability to divert from the Constitutional Budget Reserve to pay tax credits?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't know if I could provide the actual document. I summarized the content of it a couple of slides ago. If I can, most definitely we will provide it to the committee, but Ms. Grambling is in the audience. If you'd like to bring her forward, she might be able to comment on that. But otherwise, I'll go back to the Department of Law and find out what I can actually do.
Would you like to have her come forward? Please.
Let's have her come forward. That would be great.
Good
Welcome. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairs. My name is Mary Hunter Gramling. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in the Natural Resources Section. Regarding the interpretation of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, I'm an Assistant Attorney General, so I don't have authority to say today whether or not we would be able to give you that document. I will say that it was in part based on a recent Alaska court decision in Willikowski where the department or the state took the position that the constitutional or the permanent fund as a dedicated fund should be construed narrowly. And so when we were looking at HB 111 and factoring in kind of dedicated fund analysis, the CBRF is also a dedicated fund. And so that made us look at it as, well, this should be construed narrowly as well, just to be consistent. And so that's kind of how we got there. There was the bill passed, and then the decision came down on another dedicated fund, constitutional fund. And so then we just took another look at it.
Senator McKinnon, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can only speak for myself regarding the use of the CBR and moving funds away from its deposit. The legislature has tried to pay tax credits two times through the Constitutional Budget Reserve, and the governor has chose to veto them. So I'm going to need to see that legal opinion to see whether it's consistent with the case that you're referring to. So if you could please ask the Attorney General to provide that to the Senate Finance Committee and the Resource Committee Chairman, we would appreciate that.
If I could also make one kind of clarifying point on HB 111 and on this provision. In HB 111, I don't have the bill with me right now, but I think it's sections 9, 11, and maybe 16. It includes language that incorporates some of the CBRF language in there, and so that is why that interpretation was required to implement this bill. That was not, to my knowledge, a suggestion by the administration to that carryback concept. That I don't think that was from the administration. But Mr. Director Albert said that it was required that it be in there, and I don't necessarily know that that's true. It's in there. It's the law now that the carrybacks can't divert money that would otherwise go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. But as a matter of law, whether the legislator in your plenary power could have not put that restriction in there, I'm not sure.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, I want to pay back the tax credits. I just want to be legally consistent with how funds are deposited into the CBR. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bishop, you had a question.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, Senator McKinnon pretty much got it all, but I think for me, I need the discussion, and what got my curiosity going on this was the TAPS valuation that drove the $165 million, and it sounds like a tariff is not a tax, and I thought I heard that. If I didn't and I misspoke, somebody can correct me. So that's what I would need some more clarification on, ma'am, from the Attorney General.
Sure. Senator Thank Bishop you. and Ms. Gramling will kick me if I go off the rails here.
Mr. Alper, if you would identify yourself.
Ken Alper again, the Director of the Tax Division. Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, a tariff is not a tax. A tariff is a commercial transaction paid from the company shipping oil to the company that owns the pipeline. What the Constitutional Budget Reserve says, revenue resulting from an administrative proceeding or settlement of litigation, and then there's a whole series of clauses in there related to tax. And because the tariff isn't a tax, the guts of this Attorney General's opinion was that if it's a tax lawsuit, they didn't pay enough taxes, those lawsuits definitely go to the CBRF. But because it's really a tariff issue, the tax was an indirect impact of the change to the tariff calculation, and there wasn't a hard requirement to divert that money to the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
Follow-up, Senator Bishop?
Thank you.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you to the Assistant Attorney General as well. Any other questions on slide 11? All right. Not seeing any, I'll let you proceed.
And then slide 12 summarizes what we are doing with regulations packet number 2. And again, that's the one that is in the public review period right now. So the carried forward annual losses or carried forward lease expenditures. I alluded to some of these issues that needed to get worked on, the allocation among properties, and there's that word again, segments, how the ring fence is applied, the flexibility in use. What one provision that evolved working through the legislative process had to do with, I've spent $1 billion, and I'm holding this, and now my oil field is in production. How do I use that $1 billion per year? Now, if not, one version of the bill said I could use that to get down to the minimum tax level. But the problem there is, well, what if that means I can't use my per barrel credits? Well, what if my tax liability per the tax calculation is $500 million, but my actual tax owed is only $100 million because I'm going to have $400 million worth of per barrel credits? The way that provision was written, they would have lost the ability to use that $400 million. So by allowing maximum flexibility for the taxpayer, they are able to only use the amount that brings their tax calculation to, after using their per barrel credits, they get down to that minimum tax. And what it really means is they get to preserve their ability to carry those lease expenditures forward into yet further future years and not potentially lose value from that. And you've got a lot of testimony from Mr. Ruggiero, the LB&A consultant, who talked about maximizing the ability to use carried forwards, that the ability to cost recovery is an essential tenet of a net profits-based system, and the legislature went to the maximum degree to preserve the ability for cost recovery in the final language that was chosen. And that's in 4355-165, I want to say M or N, some of the new subsections that were added to the lease expenditure sections of law. The downlift calculation is an interesting calculation, and what triggers it, if lease expenditures are not used for 10 years, they begin to lose value at 10% of that amount per year. Given the syntax of that, and that was subject to a little bit of competing ideas, is it 10% of the entire value that's lost every year or 10% of the remaining value? Example, let's say you have 100 and you lose 10%, well, the next year you have 90. If you still haven't used them the year after that, do you go down to 80 or do you use 10% of the 90 and go down to the 81? That was, given the way that the section was written, the answer was 81. But there were some who would have preferred that it was 80. So the regulations were written to ensure that the 81 definition. Also a fair amount of time on this idea of reasonably related. Now the regulation package that's been made available to the committee is long. A lot of the pages are examples. The examples are there more for illustrative purposes to say, this language, complex as it is, might not be that understandable. Here, let me step you through how this would be interpreted with a real-world example. And then you see formulas and numbers, and this Company X has that. So those examples are in many ways the most helpful part of the regulations package to be able to understand what we're trying to do, and once again, what we're trying to do is appropriately interpret the will of the legislature in the guidance they gave through the bill itself. Where we are in the process, we the discussion draft went out. Now, this one actually has had two drafts already. There was a preliminary draft that went out on November 18th. We had meetings, but because it was an official public notice, we could simply talk freely to companies about it, get their input into this is what we're thinking of doing, and that was actually very helpful. We were able to clean up a few things between that and the public notice of the official draft packet 2, which didn't happen until December 21st. We don't like having these things happening during the holidays. People are out of town. People aren't at work. We felt it was important to get it done and not have the public hearing after the legislative session convened. So that sort of forced us into having these things happening during the holidays. And we apologize to industry, we apologize to you, but we ran out of calendar, and again, we wanted to get it done before the session. And the public comment period closes in 1 week, next Friday.
Thank you. Now, I'm looking at the statement you made, you gave us from the Department of Law at the very onset, and this regulation package number two actually is not something that we can comment on with you today, is my understanding, because it is still out, and this is not official public testimony. Am I getting that right?
You are free to comment on anything you want. You might not be satisfied with the depth to which we can respond to those comments.
All right. Understood. But we are free as citizens to submit written comment to you on that package that is out for public comment right now.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Great. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. Good. Other questions from committee members? Yes. Senator von Imhoff.
Thank you. So the first question I have is on slide number 11. It says near the bottom there, additional tax liability due to the recent TAP settlement is not required to go to the CBR. During that, was there interest generated by that settlement? And would interest, because when I'm studying these financial statements, I'm seeing that there are regular additions into the CBR, interest oftentimes being one of them. Did the settlement have anything interest related going into the CBR?
Through the chair, Senator von Imhoff, ultimately the settlement changed tariff calculations. It, for the most part, reduced the allowable amount of transportation expenditure for the oil that shipped in the affected years. So that reduced transportation cost filtered its way through the tax calculation, leading to an additional tax liability. And then, yes, to answer your question, interest is then charged on that tax liability. If, for example, we're talking about a 2011 change, those taxes are due on March 31st, 2012. Interest would be charged from March 31st, 2012. And then there have been, honestly, four different interest rates charged. Between then and the end of 2013, the old 11% rate is charged, compounding. For 2014, 15, and 16, the 3% plus federal discount rate simple interest is charged. For 2017, the 7% plus federal discount rate compounding is charged. And then for 2018, 5.25% plus federal discount rate is charged. So, yes, but the authority granted by the bill that passed last year is to say not just the tax but the associated interest can also be offset by transferred tax credits. So if, example, the company X owns $20 million of taxes and that turns into $30 million with all of that compounded interest, they could go out and buy $30 million worth of tax credits from another company. Let's say they buy them for $25 million, to use an example, and then use that to offset the full $30 million obligation.
So they can do that?
Yes, they can.
Any other questions? I had a question related to the regulations as they're written. Let me find the location in the regulations. And it relates to language that was in the bill. So in Sections 6, 9, and 16 of HB 111, it refers to the carried back tax credit being applied to satisfy a tax, interest, penalty, fee, or other charge. And yet in the regulations, it has much more limited language. I'm looking for the spot here, actually. I thought I had it marked. It is referring only to the tax, interest, and or penalty. It left out the last four words, fee or other charge, and it looks like it is in 305C, actually in various places in 305C, where the words tax or associated interest, penalty, but it doesn't refer to fee or other charges. So when you write the regulations, do you focus on extracting the actual language from the bill that we pass?
Mr. Larson
would be the one to answer that, huh?
Yeah. Madam Chair, through the committee, give me just a second to get the relevant part of the statute there.
Sure. In the actual bill itself, it was in 023C. Mm-hmm.
Section 6 of HB 111?
You are correct. Section 6.
Right. And so the language reads, as you said, may, regardless of when the credit was earned, be used to satisfy a tax, interest, penalty, fee, or other charge. And then there's prohibitions under subsection A, or excuse me, paragraphs A and B. And under A, it says the surcharges under 4355-201 to 4355-299 or 4355-300. And those are the surcharges. And the reason that the language was proposed and adopted as it was is that the department is not aware of any additional fees that are charged by the department other than the principal portion, the interest, and the penalty. And let me just say that for the penalty, that by and large a penalty would be considered to be a part of the administrative proceeding because it normally falls out from the issuance of a letter from the department for a late filing, something like that, for whatever reason. However, the language of the regulation, what we said was that if someone self-reports a penalty, and for example, if they knew that they misfiled or filed late, they could self-report the penalty and thereby avoid the administrative the administrative proceeding, the letter from the audit department, and use the carried back credit to pay that portion of the penalty.
Right. Okay. I guess the fundamental question, though, was leaving out the fee or other charges. Mm-hmm. Your rationale was that at this point in time, the tax division doesn't charge any fees or other charges. Is that your rationale?
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify one thing that Mr. Larson said, because you might not have caught the reference to 4355, 200, 300. The surcharge, we're talking about the nickel a barrel conservation surcharge that goes to the spill cleanup and response. That could be construed as a fee, but that was specifically carved out from this. And so you're correct. We don't have any other fees. So that's why the language was excluded from the regulations.
So if the department were to impose any other fees, our intent was the application of the statute in that case, but the word isn't in the regulations. You said at this time you don't have any fees or other charges, right? I get that part. But the fact is we wrote it in statute, and yet it doesn't appear in the regulations. Does that mean in the future, should these fees or other charges appear, then they're not there in the rules, so how would they apply? How would they be treated?
Madam Chair, first, I'm not sure under what authority the department would impose any other fees. That would be my first response.
Okay.
And then if fees were added by regulation at that point in time, then we probably would add that language in there. But as Director Alper mentioned previously, that when the department develops these regulations, we work with in conjunction with the Department of Law, and it was the consensus of the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law that since there are no other fees, that it was appropriate to not include that language in the regulation at this point in time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, should a fee be added, it would be added by legislation, and we would make sure to adjust as necessary to account for that fee in these regulations.
And thank you.
Now that's on the record, so if someone could pull that up.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Helper. Further questions? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So also looking at Statute 15, .55.305, one of the questions I have is, was the original intent of HB 111 to disallow a carried back tax credit from being used to create a tax overpayment or provide for a claim for refund? Or was the carry forward just going to be used a little bit each year and then kicked forward until it was used up? So I wasn't really sure, because I thought originally we didn't want to create that restriction.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the circumstance that we were concerned about, and we brought it to the committee's attention while it was in the Senate Finance Committee, was, okay, we can now go backwards in time, but let's say someone has paid their 2011 taxes in full, but I'm going to buy a tax credit, I'm going to say I've now applied it to my 2011 taxes, and now I've overpaid my 2011 taxes, please give me a cash refund. A kind of a workaround to the limitation on cash through the tax credit fund. We did not perceive that to be the intent of the committee, and in fact, Chair McKinnon read a statement saying that that was not the intent of the bill while the bill was still in the Finance Committee. So we felt like we had clear guidance to make sure we didn't want to create the opportunity for a purposeful overpayment leading to a cash refund, and we implemented the regulations that way.
Follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, so thank you. So I can understand the example of taxes being closed and paid, but what about taxes that are still open? Because I remember during the conversations that there was a lot of back taxes that were still, you know, I think up to 6 years that were still open and still under, review. So what if a tax is open? Can they apply that credit to that year?
So if typically companies will refile their taxes multiple times over the years because something changes. This TAP settlement is one example. That what will actually happen in practice is your company X thought they – no, and let's also be clear. These are high tax years, 2011, 12, 13, the price of oil was high. Companies were paying the state quite literally billions of dollars. So they owed $1.1 billion, and now they owe $1.2 billion because of this TAP thing, and so – that shows an incremental tax of $100 million, and we're going to pay it with these credits. If it's open because we've audited it, that audit is now we're in the CBRF restriction. It's not offsettable anyway, and it falls out the carryback. If there has been a refile of some other sort that leads to a tax liability, that tax liability can be offset with these carrybacks. What we want to make sure is if there's not a refile, if there's no indication of a tax liability, disputed or otherwise, we don't want to simply apply credits against something to overpay something that doesn't exist. I'm not exactly sure of the circumstance you're envisioning. I might need a little more clarity.
No,
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. You answered it. If there is I believe that it makes sense that if there's due to a refile, a subsequent liability, yes, they ought to be able to use the tax credits to offset that.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, and as I understand it, that is allowable. There has to be a liability. There has to be some justification, something in the math that says that liability exists.
I understand. Thank you.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you. And just to follow up, is it illegal to purposely overpay?
Through the chair, I'm looking to Mr. Larson. To my knowledge, no, but I might very well be wrong on that.
Mr. Larson.
Senator McKinnon, through the chair, or Co-Chair McKinnon, I agree with the director that, to my knowledge, I don't think that's illegal, no.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right, seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you for this overview. So, senators, the second reg package is still out for comment. I did want to point out that the Administrative Regulation Review Committee no longer exists. And so that's actually a function that we're sort of performing today. And thank you to the committees for doing this work today. So with that, that concludes our meeting. The next hearing for the Senate Resources Committee is today at 3 p.m. We'll be having a presentation from DNR, the Division of Forestry. Senator McKinnon, the next Senate Finance Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Finance members, on Monday we'll be hearing from Commissioner Fisher and the Department of Revenue on the 2017 Fall Resource Book. We have a full schedule meeting every day next week at 9 a.m., so we can go through that when we're a committee on Monday. With that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. So with that, this meeting will be adjourned. The time is 10:05 a.m.